Clearly, one of the most important new data sets in lung cancer to become available in the past year is the so-called IPASS study conducted in Asia and focusing on patients who were light or never smokers with adenocarcinoma and comparing first-line treatment in metastatic disease with either gefitinib or carboplatin paclitaxel. I met with the principal investigator of this landmark trial, Dr. Tony Mok, and he began by describing the rationale for the study.
To start off with, we know that, you know, the patient mutation actually will have a good response to the GGF-TKI, such as gefitinib. And at that time, the only way to prove the efficacy of this drug is to select the population with the mutation. But at that time in Asia, it's so difficult to do a selection by mutation only. So we decided to enrich the population, and that's how we end up with the design of the study. And the study turned out to be positive with the hazard ratio of 0.71 of the overpopulation. The primary endpoint is the progression-free survival, because knowingly, if you got mutation, you got subsequent therapy, you are likely going to have your overall survival benefit. So with that information, we actually had the benefit of 36% of the population with the samples that we can do the EGFR mutation analysis, which turned out to be 437 samples, out of which 261 were positive, meaning 60%. And for that, in the subgroup analysis, which is a preprint analysis of mutation-positive patient, we have a hazard ratio of 0.48 with p-value less than 0.01.
So a 50% reduction in recurrent progression.
Definitely. But on the other hand, in the mutation-negative patient, they have a hazard ratio of 2.86, meaning that there's a hazard to give TKI, such as gefitinib, if they're mutation-negative. Chemotherapy would do a lot better. So based on this, I think we had established the fact that in a mutation-positive patient, we can consider using the TKI as a first-line therapy.
When do you think, or is the trial even powered to look at survival?
Yes, actually, this is powered to look at survival, but then we did not assume it to be positive. And as a matter of fact, we presented the survival outcome in the ESMO, but then it was only 36% mature, and there's no difference between the two curves. The overall survival final outcome will be analyzed in early 2010.
What do you think the clinical implication of this is in terms of non-protocol therapy?
Now, EMEA had approved this drug in Europe, gefitinib, for mutation-positive patients. So I think that had already made its clinical impact. Now, they already had patients in Germany going on gefitinib with the proven mutation-positive. So the clinical practice had already started in Europe.
Just out of curiosity, you think gefitinib will ever be available in the United States?
Well, that was really very much up to FDA. FDA was asking for overall survival benefit. But in my mind, as long as the patient had crossed over, you would not have survival benefit. With such a sensitive marker and then with such a highly effective drug, if you have a crossover, you would not have overall survival benefit. And then that also have a lot to do with what is the FDA position on approval of erdafitinib for mutation-positive patient. There is a randomized study going on in Europe called the UTEC study, which is a randomized control study of the patient with mutation-positive randomized erdafitinib or chemotherapy. The study is almost completing accrual, and with that data available, is United States or FDA going to approve erdafitinib? I don't know.
So I wanted to ask you about a couple papers that you were involved in publishing. One in, is it Pathologic Oncology Research? Clinical Molecular Features of EGFR T790 Mutation and c-MET Amplification?
Right, that is the one.
That's
in
a
science.
Great paper, though I don't understand it. Maybe you can explain it to me.
Wow.
It looks, I mean, this whole thing about resistance to TKIs is fascinating.
Wow. Certainly, I don't understand it entirely either. It's a very huge collaborative effort between the Dana Farber group and ourselves, because we got more patients with the mutation and therefore more patients with resistance. So we collaborate. So what we have learned so far is the T790M, which is a mutation in exon 20, account for about 50% of all the resistance. Originally, we published Kobayashi in New England Journal of Medicine, and subsequently, you know, there are bigger samples to prove the fact they are 50%. But then what happened to the other 50%?
But you don't see this to start with? It's only after they're exposed to a TKI?
This is a fantastic question. Now, let me just explain first. In the beginning, when they identified this, they called an acquired mutation, acquired resistant mutation of exon 20 T790M. But then, you know, in IPASS, we find 11 T790M mutation out of the sample size of 437.
You mean up front?
Up front.
Wow, that's
treatment naive. My hypothesis is that actually T790M exists in the beginning, but over time that it just proliferate and become a dominant clone.
Yeah, like a natural selection kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. That is my
That makes sense. Have treatment naive T790 mutations been reported at all before? Any cases?
There are selective cases, the only case report, but then there's 11 cases.
But now you have 11 cases.
Right.
So what has been explained to me is that somehow this mutation interferes with TKI binding?
Yes. Now, that had a lot to do with so-called the concept of the signal pathway addiction. So we are talking about ATP binding, you know, in the tyrosine kinase. So with the change of the molecule, there is actually a decrease in the binding capacity to the TKI. So therefore, there's a decrease in the inhibition.
So that all kind of makes sense, but then you get into c-MET.
Yes.
What's that?
c-MET is actually a very good scientific concept because c-MET is right next to the membrane going down to the PI3K pathway, which is shared in common with the EGFR.
So c-MET's a receptor?
c-MET is a surface receptor.
Yes. So similar to EGFR?
Similar, but not exactly the same, obviously. And then with the c-MET, what happens is that when you have overexpression, you may actually have a overcoming of the pathway. I mean, so you can actually have overdrive of the PI3K, which is actually the common pathway. But over the time, in our paper, we described about 18% of the resistance can be explained by the c-MET expression.
So c-MET's a mechanism of resistance.
This is one of the mechanisms, independent of T790M. And then in other small series, one from China, we report about 15% of the resistance to be explained by the c-MET. So it's there, but then it accounts for a small proportion, and we really do not have a complete picture of such. But this will be important in a sense is that there are now c-MET inhibitors available. So in the future, whether we can apply c-MET inhibitor in the EGFR resistance, that is a possibility.
And another paper you were involved with I thought was fascinating, clinical cancer research, is the single molecule detection of EGFR mutations in plasma by microfluidics. Mm. What's that all about?
Well, this is what we need to do is we want to have a simple test to look for the CGM mutation. Now that we prove in first-line situation, if we were able to give the EGF TKI for the mutation-positive patient, then we have to find them. But nowadays in Asia, only approximately 30 to 40% of the sample are being available for EGF mutation analysis. There's still a good 60% of the lung cancer diagnosed by cytology and sputum cytology that you cannot do analysis. So the next question is, can I do a blood test? Now, the existing blood test of the circulating DNA, the sensitivity is approximately 70%. So we try to ask, can we improve this sensitivity? So what we have done is that we use something called a digital PCR. It is a panel of valve with about 9,000 valve. And then we use the hydrofluid technology. We almost deposit a piece of DNA in each valve.
So PCR, as in PCR, says, I say oncotype, that type of PCR?
Yeah, PCR sequencing.
So it's PCR on circulating cells or what?
No, PCR of the circulating DNA.
Circulating DNA.
So we basically try to get this DNA in the plasma, in the small valve, and then do PCR about 20 times, 20 run, and then amplify them. So we can look for whatever pieces of the DNA present have this mutation being existing.
Again, naive question. How does this compare to the report that came out of Dana-Farber? It was in the New England Journal.
Yeah, Dana-Farber by the Sequest Group. Actually, no, it comes from the MGH.
Group. Oh, yeah, right. It was
the
MGH.
MGH from New England. It's different.
Right.
They are circulating cells.
Cell, that's what I thought.
So it's different. So they're looking for the cell. We're looking for the circulating DNA.
So there's actually normally circulating DNA?
There's definitely circulating DNA. Actually, there's a lot of work done by our center is look for the circulating DNA in the mother's blood, the fetal DNA in the mother's blood. And that's how we actually use the similar technology to detect for the Down syndrome in the mother. That had been widely published in the obstetric group.
That's interesting because I remember Tom Lynch saying that the key person in that thing was a fetal physiologist.
Yes.
I don't know if that's connected with what you're saying.
Well, the professor in the area from our center is called Professor Dennis Lowe. That's his expertise. So I'm actually collaborating with him in terms of developing this technology. But this paper is actually preliminary. We just want to establish our technology. We're now doing a prospective study in this regard.
And what can you actually detect there? You can detect EGFR mutations?
We can detect either exon 21 or exon 19 mutation. We have the technique established for both.
Anything else?
That's it for now, because it takes a lot to develop technology since these two account for 90% of mutation. So we're just going to go for these two.
How about KRAS?
Not at this point, simply for the fact that in our population, KRAS is not a common mutation and our clinical applicability is less.
So, yeah, I'm just trying to comprehend this. You've got DNA circulating and you look at it and you see that it has the mutation.
The good thing is that all you need to do is to see one DNA, then you know that there is a DNA. You know, we may have a semi-quantification, but we don't need that because you really need to have a lung DNA to have the mutation to have one in your blood. So as long as we see one gene with a exon 19 mutation, the patient has it.
So being an oncologist, I'm always thinking about therapy, but also could this be used in detection?
Detection of
lung
you
cancer.
Now, because only about 30% of our population with the EGFR mutation with lung cancer, and also that in the Caucasian population, only 10% of the entire population had this mutation. So you cannot use it as early screening test because it's not as common.
But I wonder whether you would see it.
Possible. If you got a mutation, if our technology works, there's a good chance you can see it. But this will be the kind of test with low sensitivity, high specificity.
What fraction of patients can you actually detect DNA?
Everybody got DNA in their blood.
That's interesting.
Everybody got DNA circulating in their blood.
Cool.
One other interesting concept that we're trying to go back is on the concept of combination of chemotherapy with the TKI. So we have done a study called the FAST-ACT, which is the sequential administration of the chemotherapy on day 1 and day 8 on gemcitabo, and then on day 15 to day 28, I give the erdalib. Now, this is based on some of the preclinical work that when the two drugs are given together, they are actually antagonistic because they actually decrease the apoptosis by the erdalib and therefore chemotherapy did not work well. Fred Hirsch and Paul Bunn had done a similar study, but their study was smaller sample size and turned out to be negative except for mutation positive patient. We did it on a large population, 150 patients, randomized phase 2. It's actually positive in a progression-free survival, and then actually will be published in JCO probably about within the next month or two. This was presented by Jin-Soo Lee in the ESCO last year, and then the publication just come out in this next month or two.
And where are things heading with this strategy?
We are actually doing randomized phase 3. We are already enrolled about 15 patients for this 450 patient study.
What exactly is a randomization?
This is a randomized phase 3 study in Asia, everybody, smoker, non-smoker, adeno, non-adeno, male or female, and then randomized to either the sequential administration followed by erdalib or just the sequential with placebo, and then followed by placebo. Primary endpoint, progression-free survival.
Seems like you might want to have dissected out, you know, the actual schedule issue.
Yes, you are absolutely right in that. You are very good. We asked the question that ideally we should do a 3-arm study.
Right, right.
But number one, we did not have the money to do that. It's hugely costly. And number two is that with the Saturn being positive, then we got some idea that the maintenance did have a role. But then and also look at the progression-free survival curve in randomized phase 2 study. The separation of the progression-free survival curve started at about 8 weeks and 10 weeks. So therefore, the difference of the progression-free survival benefit started when it was a sequential administration and then maintained it on during the maintenance phase.
What's the sort of biologic, theoretical reason why this kind of schedule might be more effective?
Well, it's due to the apoptosis situation because of the erdalib would decrease the apoptosis, and therefore the chemotherapy doesn't work well if there is a decrease in apoptosis.
Why don't we talk about some of your cases?
Okay.
Maybe we can start with your 55-year-old man.
Okay, well, this is true life experience, 55, non-smoking Chinese male, and, you know, come in with cough and shortness of breath and find that there is a 2.5 centimeter mass with the mediastinal lymphadenopathy and bilateral lung nodule. And then on biopsy, it was no endobronchiolation for biopsy, but then only a BAL, you have some cytology showing adenocarcinoma, but we cannot do the mutation analysis. So the question is, what do we do from there? Are we just happy with a cytological diagnosis using clinical parameter, non-smoking, male, Asian, and with adenocarcinoma, and to choose your therapy, or whether we should go for further diagnosis?
I just kind of like a little friendly argument with a clinical investigator about exactly this question. And I said, I think you ought to get tissue and get an EGFR mutation. I'd want to see it if it were me.
Right.
But that person wasn't quite as convinced. What's your answer?
Well, this argument is going to linger on for a long time. Because if you look at the overall population of the IPAS, with the clinical selection, you have a hazard ratio of 0.71. You got a response rate of 42% versus 32%. So in the normal circumstances, then you would say that this is a positive study. I got sufficient data to use it. But on the other hand, if you look into the data of the EGFR mutation negative patient, which account for 40% of the situation, they actually had detrimental effect. So based on that, I personally will choose to do the biopsy. And then I will even go for a VATS to biopsy a lung nodule.
So the argument on the other side that I just heard was, well, you can always bring in the TKI later. And I was thinking, well, you know, if I was the patient, I think I'd rather have a TKI than chemotherapy, first of all, to start with, don't you think, or not really? I mean,
well,
TKIs are not that easy.
If a patient had ever experienced the fact that a dramatic improvement of TKI when you have a load of disease that melts away in 2 weeks, you would not think about chemotherapy. I mean, yes, you can do it later, but if you ask the patient to have the choice of taking one pill a day and then your tumor melts away within 2 weeks, the patient would choose that.
Well, like another argument this person didn't make, but I've heard from other people as well, just try the TKI.
Yes, that is another way of doing so, but there's two potential problems with such.
I mean, we don't just try trastuzumab, you know?
That's one reason. And the other is that there are potential risks. This is another true life story that actually just happened 2 weeks ago. This is a Chinese lady come in with bilateral lung nodule, small effusion, and then also superior lymph node. I told her that cytology is not good enough, I'm going to biopsy your lymph node. So I biopsied the lymph node, but then it takes about 2 weeks before I can get the result. So I start her on the TKI. But on day 8, she come back bilateral pleural effusion, massive and very short of breath. So I have to put in chest drain to improve respiration, and they come out certainly mutation negative. And so imagine that it's not without risk. You put him a TKI, and for example, you give him a TKI to come back in 4 weeks, the patient can run into major trouble.
So you got an ALK fusion cooking on her?
If I got enough tissue, I certainly would do that.
So getting back to your 55-year-old man.
Yeah, and this one, I personally will do the biopsy. But people will use the IPAS data, and August the 3rd, Jin Soo Lee is going to present a Korean randomized study, similar population.
I saw that. It looks like IPAS, right?
No, exactly, the IPAS design. But then the prime endpoint over survival. Data is actually very similar. And then, you know, this also again that he got a positive progression-free survival in a selected group of patients. And then his number of patients with EGFR mutation is smaller. But it would be very interesting, you know, to see, hey, now you've got two studies showing that you can use clinical selection. Are you going to change your practice like that? Personally, I believe in mutation. By any way, I will get a mutation before I use a clinical selection.
So did you get a biopsy in this man yet?
Yes, I did. And it's positive, and he's on TKI. He's doing extremely well.
He's responding?
He's responding beautifully.
I've actually been surprised that there hasn't been more mutation testing even before IPAS. I mean, 3 years ago, I wasn't, again, looking at what happens like in breast cancer, when everybody's tumor gets sent for HER2 and ER, you have this marker. I mean,
there's two reasons for that. One is the lack of standardization.
And of the testing?
For the testing, because everybody have their own way of sequencing it, and there's no standardization how to do it. And then there's come this commercial kit, the DXS commercial kit, make it a little bit more standardized using the ARMS technique. And second, there's still also an unresolved so-called patency issue. Whether you use it clinically, you have to pay for the patency.
Let me ask you, in your own practice, or maybe your practice isn't even typical, but what fraction of patients are non-smokers?
30%.
30% so much greater. But what fraction of the population smokes?
In Hong Kong, it's only about 18% of the population smoker.
Really?
That's not bad, huh?
No, I mean, I don't know why I had the impression that there... I mean, I guess South America is much higher, right?
China is much higher.
China
male is up to 50%.
50%.
And the female is about 15% or less.
What about Europe?
Europe is high, depending on which country. Scotland, obviously. Germany is high.
How high?
I was talking about close to 40 to 50%.
So is it really the non-smoking that leads to so many mutations in Asian population,
well,
or is it
no,
genetics?
I think it is that once you smoke, your pathway is dominated by the tobacco carcinogen. When you are not smoking,
it can be both genetic and your environmental situation. So the type of mutation would be different.
But what I mean, and I know this is a basic question, like when you talked about your collaboration with Dana-Farber because you have so many patients with mutations, is the reason there's so many patients with mutations the fact that there's less smoking, or is it genetic related to being Asian?
I think it's both. Huh. But then once you get the EGFR mutation, it doesn't matter whether you're Chinese or Caucasian.
Right.
So, but it's just the incidence high because I think the pathogenesis allow the non-smoker allow the pathogenesis of this pathway to happen.
And I think maybe we should just reemphasize, because we've been running through a lot of stuff here, the message that I got out of IPASS was that you just can't go on the phenotype. You can have an Asian non-smoking woman, but if she doesn't have a mutation, that's a different story.
That's absolutely correct.
And you could, I mean, do you see mutations in patients who smoke?
Yes, definitely.
What do you think the mechanism is in general about how TKIs benefit, if they do, in patients who don't have the mutation?
Now, that will come into a lot to the Saturn study and also the BR21. Because in the Saturn study, in over survival, in the wild type, they actually have a survival benefit with the maintenance of Saturn, in the maintenance of ertilib. You have to ask the question, why? You know, I mean, these are the patients with some mutation. How do they benefit them? So we can only speculate. One of my speculation is that there are actually subclinical mutation existing. Because whenever you got a tumor, it's not homogeneous that every single cell within your tumor is having the mutation. Maybe it's a predominant mutated one, so whenever you biopsy it, you got a good chance of seeing the mutation. But what if it's only 20% of the cell that are mutated? When you do a biopsy, it's mutation negative. But then when you give a TKI like ertilib, maybe it works on those so-called subclinical detectable, undetectable of mutated cell. So you will have some type of control and stabilization of the tumor.
Let's talk about your 42-year-old woman.
Right. So this is a classical IPASS patient, type of non-smoking female with the headache and memory loss, and find to have a frontal mass and multiple small brain map. And then we were able to confirm it is adenocarcinoma and even did a mutation because we got a biopsy about exon 19 deletion. So the question is, what do you do with the predominant symptoms of brain met? The lung lesion is small. Are you going to give the radiation? Are you going to give the TKI?
Now, how were her symptoms once you got her on steroids?
She improved.
So I guess the issue would be maybe, I mean, clearly you see responses in mutation patients to TKIs in the brain, right?
Definitely. There are two phase two studies with gefitinib, one from Taiwan, one from Italy, showing that there's a benefit. And there are multiple series on the ertilib case theory showing benefit. But the question is that there's no prospective study, no randomized study. And then whole brain RT is the current standard. Are you going to skip the current standard and go right for it?
What kind of work did this woman do?
She is actually the wife of a baker, and she's the mother of three children.
And to what extent was she able to understand what was going on, and was she involved in it? Or was it more just tell me what to do?
No, she's quite...
I guess what I'm wondering is, did she have any concerns about... Of course she wanted to live and be able to take care of her family, but did she have any concerns about maybe the effects of radiation on her thinking and cognitive function?
There is a concern of hair loss, obviously, and there is also the concern of the survival. It takes a long discussion for me to explain to both her and her husband about the lack of evidence and how am I going to take a leap of faith to do that. So actually what I did is that I actually started her on the ertilib. One of the reasons is that because they are better CNS data on ertilib. There are studies on glioblastoma multiforme. So therefore, I got more clear pharmacokinetic evidence that it penetrated the brain. And then I do the MRI in 2 weeks, just in case that I'm missing it. And so, but quite clearly, in 2 weeks' time, the brain lesion improved and also the lung lesion improved in 2 weeks' time. So my advice, you know, from this learning is that if you really want to take the leap of faith without the supporting evidence, monitor it very closely.
So where is she right now?
She is home.
So how long has she been under treatment?
She's about 3 months now. And then her last MRI, so further improvement, this is about 2.5 months from the original one.
Again, you know, with a lethal disease, that's your concern. But I'm just kind of curious about your own observation in terms of the CNS effects of radiation. Do you think you see that in your patients?
Well, most of the lung cancer patients did not live long enough to have the problem. But now with the TKI, they live longer, and so we don't know yet. I think we are entering a new era now to learn of this effect of the radiation to the CNS.
Let's talk about your 70-year-old patient who has an exon 21, L858R. She got put on gefitinib. Where was the tumor?
The tumor was actually lung and bone.
So she presented with metastatic disease?
Metastatic disease. And then she had responded very nicely. And then there's a single lesion progression on the sternum. And so we give RT, and then after our radiation to the sternum is shrinking a bit, we get her back on the gefitinib. But then, 6 months later, the disease progressed again. And this time, not just the sternum, multiple bone also progressed. So the question is that this is actually the common problem that everybody see. Good duration of control, and then progress. What do you do?
You give them an irreversible EGFR inhibitor?
Well, that is actually the study ongoing, that the BIBW2992. That data has not come out as yet. Pasiyani presented the other agent, the PF2998084.
So there are two irreversible inhibitors.
There's two
EGFR,
one by Pfizer, one by BI. And then the BI1, Pasiyani presented the phase 2 data, and then there's also a phase 1-2 data by Kunju Park, which is actually a so-called pharmacogenetic study.
But now, were these people who had TKIs before?
All of them had TKI before, but not all of them had mutation. So it turned out that this patient who had TKI progressed, go on, this response rate is actually not that high. If I remember correctly, it's about only 2 patients that have response, and the majority of the patient actually have stable disease. I think they have a stable disease about 38%.
But I mean, if you see a response on somebody who progressed on an EGFR TKI, a non-irreversible one, that's kind of interesting in and of itself.
Well, in principle, the irreversible will work well if there's T790M mutation. Remember that the T790A mutation, the single amino acid changes decrease the bonding. But if the drug is actually already become bonded to it irreversibly, your T790M cannot do much about it.
So what did you do with this lady?
This lady, actually, there's 2 options, but what I did was something experimental. I actually give a combination of cetuximab and gefitinib.
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
Has there been any data actually reported?
No, there are some preclinical data presented by Jose Bezego on colorectal cancer. I have a couple cases. This is one of the cases. But, you know, actually, it worked. You know, this patient actually had a response again, and then the disease was sustained for about another 9 months.
On cetuximab and gefitinib. Makes sense.
The rash is terrible.
I bet.
And I have to adjust the doses a bit.
Much worse than either one alone.
So, and then you ask the question, why don't you do a study? Well, if somebody sponsored me, I would do it.
Interesting. So this lady responded and then what?
And then 9 months later progressed, and now she's on Alimta. She's just not doing well. But look at it. This is almost 3.5 years.
Interesting.
I mean, this is a lady, stage 4 bone met 3.5 years ago, and now this is the time that she started to deteriorate. But before then, she had been living a normal life for 3 years.
Other than a bad rash, any other toxicity issues?
Not too bad at all.
Just diarrhea?
Not much diarrhea, just terrible rash.